A Roman Catholic diocese is about to buy a beacon of Protestant televangelism. The Crystal Cathedral, a temple of glass in Garden Grove, California, will go for more than $57 million. The decision leaves some congregants furious and the future of the church up in the air. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
When the Crystal Cathedral declared bankruptcy last year, it soon became clear the legendary building would have to be sold. There were several offers, but in the end, the church's board favored the Catholic diocese in Orange County, California. Sheila Schuler-Coleman, the cathedral's pastor, said in a videotaped message it was the best way to save the church.
The Catholic plan affords us the possibility of continuing all of our wonderful, beautiful ministries, and we all know that a church is not a building.
Of course, if any church is associated with its building, it's Crystal Cathedral, which was built by the architect Philip Johnson and became famous for its televised Hour of Power services, led by Coleman's charismatic father, Robert Schuler. The cathedral shunned a bid by nearby Chapman University, which actually offered $2 million more than the diocese. For his part, Todd Brown, the Catholic Bishop of Orange, is thrilled. The diocese needed a cathedral. It didn't occur to him to try for the Crystal Cathedral until some of his advisors pulled him aside and said,
"Look, this is an incredible location and the iconic cathedral, and it will really serve our needs so well, and it will be much less expensive to acquire this property than it will be for us to build out a new cathedral."
About one-fourth of the cost. The rise and fall of the Crystal Cathedral has many twists, from Robert Schuler's message of positive thinking to his booming television ministry to the power struggle among his children when he retired.
But in the end, it's about living beyond your means.
Richard Florey teaches at the University of Southern California. He says the church had enormous costs, maintaining the building and the services, which included professional musicians and a yearly Christmas pageant that cost $2 million. At the same time, Florey says, the Crystal Cathedral did not adapt to the times.
They stuck with a particular model of what church was supposed to be and sound and feel like, and I think generationally, people started to look for other things.
In short, it lost market share. And it lost the loyalty of congregants like Bob Canfield.
It's a slap in the face.
Canfield is angry that the board shunned Chapman University's offer, but he's furious about the Schuler family.
They've been taking the exorbitant salaries, knowing for the last 8-10 years that they were going down the tubes slowly but surely.
The family alienated many. For example, when it asked for food donations for Robert Schuler's ailing wife, it announced the donations would be delivered in a limousine. It's not clear what happens to Crystal Cathedral's congregation. Sheila Schuler-Coleman said they can stay in the building for up to 3 years, and she held out hope for a miracle.
There is still time for God to step in and rescue Crystal Cathedral Ministries.
But in all likelihood, they'll have to find a new place to rent and hope that their congregants follow, even without the spectacular cathedral. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
This is NPR News. Now, something completely unfair, something sure to make your mouth water. Listen to this description of a rising star in the apple world, an apple called Sweet Tango.
Sweet Tango has much larger cells than other apples, and when you bite into it, the cells shatter rather than cleaving along the cell walls, as is the case with most popular apples. The bursting of the cells fills your mouth with juice. Chunks of Sweet Tango snap off in your mouth with a loud cracking sound. Although a crisp texture is the single most prized quality in an apple, even more desirable than taste, according to one study, crispness is more a matter of acoustics than mouthfeel. Vibrations pass along the lower jaw and set the cochlea trembling.
That's New Yorker writer John Seabrook reading from his article titled Crunch in this week's food issue. And John Seabrook, you're describing this apple really like almost like a starlet. You describe her sunburned shoulders and her freckles. Born in Minnesota, this apple?
She's born in Minnesota, bred in Minnesota. Her mother is the Honeycrisp, which a lot of people know and love. And her father is an apple called the Zestar, which is also around, but people don't know it quite as well.
So that's the parentage right there.
Right.
Sweet Tango has her, it's hard not to think of it as a her, has her own Twitter feed and her own Facebook page.
She's a very modern apple. As I said in the article, she's more like the apple on my laptop than the apple I used to carry in my lunchbox.
When you describe the sound of biting into this apple, you write that it's like hearing with your mouth or tasting music. What about the taste? What does Sweet Tango taste like?
Well, it is sweet, like Honeycrisp, but it also has this great sort of lemony finish, almost a tropical taste that I think cuts the sweetness and really makes it just very memorable. And the flesh of it is also very crisp, and it's got a kind of a powdery texture to it, which I think tastes really nice and clean and just really a delightful experience eating one.
Okay, now apart from the qualities that make this apple remarkable, your story is also a business story because Sweet Tango has a trademark. It's what's called a managed apple. Why don't you explain what that means?
Well, as most people who shop for apples have probably observed, in the last 10 years or so, a lot of new varieties have come into the supermarkets with names like Pink Lady, Gala, Jazz. Sweet Tango is kind of the next of those modern apples that are all trademarked. They also all are patented, of course. Growers have to pay the university, in this case, for a license to grow the tree, and they're trademarked. So they also have to pay a royalty on the number of apples that they sell.
I'd never thought about the business of apples in quite this way. The university here is the University of Minnesota, which has a very active apple breeding program, and they have set up a consortium, right, to market and grow.
Right. So the deal is that the Honeycrisp apple was released in an open release, and that meant that anybody who wanted to could grow it anywhere they wanted to grow it in any way they wanted to grow it. And that meant that the quality of the Honeycrisp varied widely. So with the new apple, with the Sweet Tango, the university decided they were going to manage the release, and that meant that in order to grow the apple, you have to be granted the right to grow it by this consortium. And if they don't like where you're growing it or who you are or what your track record is, they won't give you that license. Also, it means that you can't sell your apples to a supermarket. You have to sell them to the consortium, and they do the marketing. Overall, it's an attempt to control the quality of the apple and ensure the long-term longevity of the brand.
You know, we wanted to find some Sweet Tangos to taste for ourselves, but we are out of luck. I guess the season's over. We're going to have
the
to
wait season's
next
over,
year.
And that's kind of a, I mean, it's too bad for you, but it's kind of a cool thing. It's like the old days, you know, you get it when it's in the stores, and when the season's over, you just got to wait till next year.
It's John Seabrook. His article about the Sweet Tango apple in this week's New Yorker magazine is titled Crunch. John, thanks very much.
Thanks, Melissa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Melissa Block. Zynga is the company behind popular Facebook games like Farmville and Cityville. Over 200 million people play Zynga games each month. And before the end of the year, the company is expected to have its initial public offering. Industry analysts have valued it at $15 to $20 billion.
Not everyone is a fan, though. One video game designer recently set out to parody Zynga's games by creating an absurd version of his own. PJ Vogt from WNYC's On the Media has the story of an attempt at satire that didn't exactly go to plan.
Last summer, Cindy Barrett got hooked on this Facebook game. The way the game works, you get a point every time you click. Cindy was battling her brother Eric, who was routinely beating her.
At that point, I maybe had 10 clicks a week. My brother would always have 12 clicks, and it would make me frustrated. So I befriended the top clickers. They taught me how to get more clicks. Literally within a day, I had something like 200 clicks. And I was like, hey, Eric, is there any way you can compete with me? Because I think at that point he had 6. And it just went downhill from there.
The game is called Cow Clicker. It's the work of a video game designer named Ian Bogost. Bogost creations are usually more like art than entertainment. people don't typically get hooked on them. Take his most recent work, a game poem called A Slow Year. The point of the game is to experience the seasons.
The winter game, the sun is rising, it's dawn, and you've got a cup of coffee, which is slowly getting cold, and you want to kind of time your enjoyment of the cup of coffee with the amount of time that it's going to take the sun to rise. It's a first-person drinking game for the Atari.
Bogost hates popular social networking video games. Games like Farmville that clog your Facebook newsfeed with notifications about how your aunt just harvested her virtual crops or your dad put out a hit on a mob boss. He decided the best way to criticize those games would be to make the dumbest one he could imagine. That was CowClicker, the game Cindy found. The reductio ad absurdum of Facebook games.
You know, a game in which all you do is click on a cow and that's it. Maybe you pay for the privilege to click on a cow.
You click your cow, it moves. Wait 6 hours and you can click it again. Or you can get virtual money, either through clicks or by spending real cash that you spend to reset the timer and immediately click again.
People took notice. The media took notice.
Leah Alexander is a game journalist who's also friends with Bogost. She wrote about CowClicker for the website Kotaku.
He was in every gaming magazine and some non-gaming magazines regarding CowClicker. It was much more popular than I think he had ever predicted it would be.
Game journalists liked CowClicker because they got the joke. And as more players poured in, Bogost was surprised to find himself feeling pretty proud.
Gleeful. I mean, when people play your game, you can't help but feel pleasure. That's what you want. And I did feel that way for some time, especially when, you know, there was a relatively even distribution of different kinds of reactions.
The resulting buzz brought in more players, but most of them weren't in on the joke.
Somewhere along the line, his larger user base began to be people who either they understood it was a joke and they still enjoyed it, or they just didn't get it, or they just didn't care. Like, people really loved their cows.
50,000 people. For many of them, CowClicker was just another mindless, addictive Facebook game, indistinguishable from the mindless, addictive games it was meant to parody.
The ironist players dropped off. What I was left with were real players who were making demands, you know, who wanted things that I wasn't giving them in the game. They wanted different cows. They, you know, they wanted, like, Cthulhu.
Wait, Cthulhu?
Yeah, they wanted a Lovecraftian Cthulhu cow, Cthulhu.
That's the bovine equivalent of a tentacled creature named Cthulhu, created by H.P. Lovecraft and beloved by geeks. Still psyched that people were into his game, Bogost gave them what they wanted.
You know, there's a pirate cow, a ninja cow, and a cow that cost over $100. When you bought that cow, we sent a real cow to the third world, you know. I was very eager to put more material into the game to see how people would react.
But eventually, he got uneasy.
After a while, I realized they're doing exactly what concerned me about these games. They were, you know, becoming compulsively attached to it. There was one point when I realized that I was now attached to it in a compulsive way. I was worrying about what the CowClickers thought while I was away from the game. And that was the moment at which I both felt kind of empathy with the players and also I began to feel very disturbed by the product.
He decided to sabotage the game, to tweak it, to make it more maddening, more dumb.
At one point, he took the default cow, switched it to face the other direction, and charged $20 for it. And people bought it.
Bogost couldn't diminish people's love for CowClicker. The game generated its own fan culture.
CowClicker poetry, silkscreen printed t-shirts. There was this woman who did these sort of CowClicker portraits of all her CowClicker friends.
Bogost decided that if he couldn't ruin CowClicker, he'd kill it. He got in touch with friends across the world, and he had them hide clues in the real world for CowClicker diehards to find. Once assembled, the clues spelled out a chilling prophecy.
Cowpocalypse. And then there was this timer that started running, and if the timer ended, then, you know, the game would shut down. At least that was the implication. I never really said what would happen.
In a final twist of perversity, Bogost designed his game-ending countdown clock to speed up whenever anyone played the game and to reset if people paid money.
I wanted the players to feel like they were accelerating their own demise by playing and then be tempted to maybe purchase their way out of it. And several people, like, extended the clock at the very last minute a few times.
When you create something, you don't get to decide how it'll be received. Ian Bogost's game wasn't designed to be enjoyable, but it turned out to be possibly the most resonant game he's ever made. His take on what that might mean is actually pretty optimistic.
It shows us how weird and complicated simple things really are, and shows me not that, like, I'm some sort of brilliant designer who made this thing that was bigger than I thought it was, but how resilient and creative people are. I did this thing that was CalClicker, and in spite of it, they rose above and sort of made it something more than it really was.
That's one way to look at it. Here's another. You remember that countdown clock?
When the clock finally counted down to zero, there was a cow rapture.
Here's how the cowpocalypse actually transpired.
All of the cows were whisked away, and all that was left were the little shadows where they had been standing. But the game continued to run, and in fact, the game continues to run to this day. And there are still people clicking on the spot where a cow used to be.
Bogo still gets messages from confused cow clickers. A typical complaint, which Lee Alexander, the video game journalist, published, read that after the rapture, Cow Clicker was, quote, not a very fun game any longer. Bogost answered, it wasn't very fun before. For Bogost, Cow Clicker was never about fun. It was a joke. But as it turned out, the joke was on him. I'm PJ Vogt.
PJ Vogt reports for WNYC's On the Media.
This is NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You probably know that the moon has an effect on the Earth, right, in the form of the tides. But there's another effect you probably haven't thought about, and I'm talking about the presence of our moon helping to stabilize the tilt of the planet, and that in turn helps to moderate the seasons. Seasons are caused by the tilt of the Earth. You did know that. So what would happen if our moon wasn't there? And does that mean that planets elsewhere in the universe need a moon if they want to have a good chance of supporting life? One person who has thought about that is Jason Barnes. He's an assistant professor of physics at the University of Idaho in Moscow, and he joins us from the studios of Northwest Public Radio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
What makes you think about the moon? What got into you?
Our moon is particularly unusual in that our moon relative to the size of the Earth is the biggest moon in the solar system. So whether or not that really plays into whether or not life developed here on Earth or where life goes was of interest.
And besides the waves I talked about, the tides, I tried to explain a little bit about the moon and the tilt of the Earth. Could you get into that a little bit?
Sure. Well, the tilt of the Earth is what causes the seasons. It's the difference between whether the equator is pointed right at the sun or whether it's tilted away. So our Earth is tilted about 23.5 degrees with respect to the sun, and it's that tilt that causes the seasons. And so even with our moon, that tilt varies by a little bit, but it varies by about a degree over the course of hundreds of thousands of years. So when that tilt is a little bit higher, when Earth is tilted more, then the seasons are more extreme. So like the summers are a bit hotter and the winters are colder. Mm-hmm. And when the tilt is less, then the seasons are moderated to the degree that then the summers are cooler and the winters are warmer.
Mm-hmm. And the moon helps stabilize that tilt?
Right. So it's with the moon that those variations are about 1 degree. Mm-hmm. Part of our work was calculating what that difference would be without the moon. And so without the moon, it turns out the Earth's axis tilt would vary by 10 degrees back and forth instead of just 1 degree.
That's pretty extreme, is it not?
It seems like a lot. I mean, considering this 1 degree tilt, you think, oh, gosh, what could 1 degree do? It turns out that 1 degree tilt over hundreds of thousands of years is what causes the ice ages. That small tilt, when the seasons are more extreme, so when the summers are hotter and the winters are colder, that melts off the glaciers that used to cover North America and northern Siberia 15,000 years ago. And when the seasons are less extreme, so when the summers are cooler and the winters are warmer, there's more snow and there's less melted off, and that's what causes the glaciers to form. So even that 1 degree tilt causes these huge shifts in Earth's climate into glaciated and non-glaciated states. And without the moon, we'd be wandering back and forth 10 times that amount.
And would life then be possible, or would it be the same as we know it without the moon?
Well, it certainly would be different in that we'd be going through these variations every 10,000 years. But the fact that Earth right now is wandering back and forth between these glaciated and non-glaciated states is actually very unusual in Earth's history. So that 1 degree tilt makes a big difference these days because Earth's present-day climate is sort of on a seesaw. We're exactly at the tipping point of a seesaw, such that that little 1 degree tilt can flip us back and forth into glaciated and non-glaciated states.
Now,
for the vast majority... For the mass majority of Earth's history, that's not been the case. In fact, there hasn't even been ice at Earth's poles for 85% of Earth's history. So the fact that there's any glaciers at all on Earth is unusual. And so our thought is that, you know, for a typical condition, the 10-degree variation in the tilt of the Earth would actually not make as big a difference as you might think. I think life would certainly be affected, but it would go on. It wouldn't kill everything.
So if you're looking for exoplanets, planets outside of our solar system, then it really wouldn't make a difference if there was a moon attached to one of them or not.
Well, it makes some difference, but not as much as we previously thought. So I don't know if you've heard of Fermi's question, which was in the 1940s during the Manhattan Bomb Project. Enrico Fermi, a famous particle physicist, was sitting around with a bunch of the other Manhattan Project scientists. And he asked, they were talking about aliens and the probability that there would be extraterrestrial life out there. And suddenly, Enrico Fermi sits down and thinks about it for a while and he says, "Where is everybody?" As if you if you calculate how many alien civilizations there should be out there, you come up – usually, if you kind of plug in the typical numbers, you come up with huge numbers of civilizations in the galaxy. But we haven't found any. Why not? So that's Fermi's – that's the essence of Fermi's question.
Mm-hmm. And that has to do with looking for them and how many more might be possible if you didn't have to have a moon around the planet.
Right. Right. So there's a hypothesis called the rare Earth hypothesis by Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee at the University of Washington. And for, you know, people have been trying to solve Fermi's questions for a long time. Their suggestion was perhaps the obvious solution. Maybe the reason we haven't found any extraterrestrial life is because there isn't any, or there isn't any that's able to contact us. And so if that's true, then somewhere along the line, our calculations for how many Earth-like habitable worlds should be out there must be wrong. So they looked through at the various different parts, various different places along the line where this where the chain might have broken down. For instance, maybe Earth-sized planets don't form very often, or perhaps they get hit by meteorites or asteroids too often that wipes out their life, like an asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And one of their options was maybe that it's this moon stabilizing the Earth's climate that allows life to survive here, and that if you didn't have a moon then, you might have many fewer habitable worlds in the galaxy.
Hmm. And your research is saying, well, it might be a little bit different, but not enough to wipe out life on a planet that didn't have a moon.
Exactly. So calculations for how many planets out there might have Earth-sized moons, there was a recent paper that suggested there might be maybe 1 in 12. So maybe 8% of planets would have a moon as big as the Earth, as big as Earth's moon. But, you know, our calculations show that while without the moon, in our present condition, the Earth would certainly go through these 10-degree shifts back and forth. A typical planet, if you just gave it a random spin, probably wouldn't have nearly as large a variation. In fact, if you had just a random orientation for the Earth's rotation, its typical variation in the axis tilt would be a lot lower than 10 degrees and sometimes lower than even we have with the moon. So what we found is that you really don't need a moon to stabilize the Earth or to stabilize a typical extrasolar planet, I should say, and that probably 80% or so of extrasolar planets will have this climate stability that we need instead of 8%. So that gives you 10 times more habitable planets in the galaxy than we previously thought.
Now we know that the moon was closer to the Earth millions and millions of years ago, and it is gradually still moving away from the Earth. Would that have an effect on the tilt again?
That's a great point, Ira. So the fact that the moon is slowly moving away means that its effect is slowly shifting over time. So in the past, when the moon was closer, it was causing Earth to precess, Earth's axis to precess faster. So the Earth has a tilt, but which direction that tilt points changes over time, and the Earth's axis precesses every 26,000 years.
Like a spinning top does when it's on the table. It sort of rotates.
Exactly.
Around.
Yeah. That's a great analogy. And so it's this precession that actually causes what we call the precession of the equinoxes. So the date of the equinox and the solstice keeps shifting around the calendar, so it's about one day later every century. And so that precession rate is what ends up governing whether or not Earth's axis tilt remains stable or kind of goes haywire. And so as the moon moves further away, calculations have shown that, in fact, the moon will, as its influence decreases, Earth sometime in the future, probably about 1.5 billion years from now, will enter an unstable phase where the moon is no longer able to stabilize Earth's axis tilt, and will probably enter into one of these situations where our axis tilt and the intensity of the seasons changes quite intensely over hundreds of thousands of years.
That's very interesting. And what got you interested in studying the moon?
Well, in general, I'm interested in this from the very point that you're talking about of extraterrestrial habitability. So I'm a collaborator on a NASA mission called Kepler. Mm-hmm. And this mission is a 1-meter telescope that we launched into space to look for Earth-sized planets around other stars for the first time. And what's interesting is that we hope, and I think there's every reason to think this will be true, that in a couple years we will have discovered the first Earth-sized planet at an Earth-like distance from its star, such that we think it should have liquid water on its surface. Then the next question is, gosh, should that planet then harbor life? Should that be a habitable planet? And so mm-hmm. That's where I came into this. I wondered, gee, if you just took a random planet and set it up with or without a moon, what are its axis tilt variations, and would that control whether or not it's habitable? I.e., when we look at a planet out there and Kepler finds a planet in a couple of years, do we have to know whether it has a moon in order to say whether or not it's habitable? And so what's interesting about our work is that although a moon definitely affects the climatic habitability, I don't think you have to necessarily find a moon around a planet in order to know that it might have a stable enough climate to be habitable.
Right. Why do you say in a couple of years? It takes that long to sift through all that stuff out there?
Great question. So the technique that Kepler is using to find planets is called the transit technique. So it's actually very difficult to just go out with a telescope and take a picture of a planet around another star. And the reason for that is that stars are really bright and they're very far away from us. So the planets that are near them are really close to them in the sky. So if you try to take a picture of them, they're sort of washed out by the glare of the star. This has been thought to be like looking at for a firefly next to a searchlight from 10 miles away. So our technique, we're using a smarter way to find planets, and that's where we wait as the planets orbit around their star. We wait until the planet passes between the star and the Earth. So essentially then, if you were looking at the star, you'd see the shadow of the planet. So we don't actually see that shadow. We measure how bright the star looks. And when the planet goes in front of the star, the effective brightness or the measured brightness of the star goes down a bit. It's about 1% for a Jupiter-sized planet and 0.01% for an Earth-sized planet. And so to find these planets, to find an Earth-like planet then, it's probably going to be in about a 1-year orbit. So we want to see at least 3 transits of the planet so we can be sure that we're really seeing a planet and not some sort of transient activity on the star, star spots, that sort of thing. So it's going to take at least, 3 or 4 years for us to see these 3 solid transits. And so we launched in March of 2009. So it'll be a couple more years yet before we've gotten enough observing baseline to be able to have seen the 3 transits of an Earth-sized planet and then look through the data and find them and verify that that truly is a planet. So that's why it's going to take a couple years yet before we get an answer.
Well, Professor Barnes, you'll come back and talk about it, won't you, when you do that?
I sure will, if you'd like.
All right, good. We'll put you on the calendar. Jason Barnes, an assistant professor of physics at the University of Idaho in Moscow. Well, thank you for your time. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks.
Have a happy holiday. After the break, we're going to take one. We'll talk about the war dividing the solar industry, the result of, all those cheap Chinese solar panels flooding the market. Well, if you have all those panels, that drives down the cost of solar power. On the other hand, it takes away the manufacturing jobs because they're overseas. We'll talk about the whole debate. You can help talk about it. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Albert Einstein better be watching his back. Physicists have added fuel to a fire that could destroy one of Einstein's fundamental notions. Nothing travels faster than the speed of light. Well, back in September, a team of scientists first claimed that a subatomic particle called the neutrino could travel faster than the speed of light. Needless to say, there were skeptics. Now, physicists have done it again with a fine-tuned experiment that matches the previous results. To explain just how earth-shaking this could be, we're joined by Brian Green. He's a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University and author most recently of The Hidden Reality. Brian Green, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so the idea that nothing travels faster than the speed of light, that obviously is part of Einstein's theory of relativity. This is a foundation of physics. These new experiments have basically rocked the scientific community. Explain why. Well, no one anticipated that a particle could go faster than the speed of light. And frankly, I should say at the outset, most physicists don't believe that any particle does go faster than the speed of light. No, I mean, these are very difficult experiments when you're trying to calculate the precise speed of this little ghostly particle called a neutrino. And many of us think that it will take an independent experiment, doing it a different way, getting the same answer before we believe it.
So you're one of those skeptics?
Hugely so.
All right.
And I think if you were to do a survey of most physicists, we'd all pretty much say the same thing. An extraordinary result like this, in the worlds of Carl Sagan, requires extraordinary evidence, and we don't have that extraordinary evidence yet.
Okay. Can you explain, first of all, what neutrinos actually are?
They are little tiny particles of matter that are the most standoffish, if you will, of the particles that we know of. They can pass through trillions of miles of lead without being deflected, just pass right through. So they're ghostly particles that we require in order to make sense of data from particle accelerators around the world, to make sense of observations of astrophysical phenomenon. So we know the neutrinos are certainly real, but their speed is what is at question here.
So these physicists at CERN, this lab in Switzerland, can you explain how they came to this conclusion that they have managed to send particles traveling faster than the speed of light?
In principle, it's quite straightforward. They take these particles and they fire them from Switzerland to another receptor at another laboratory in Gran Sasso in Italy. And what they do is they calculate how long it took the neutrinos to get there, and they calculate how long the journey is, and that's all you need to figure out speed.
So why all the skepticism if they've basically shown that it's faster?
Well, it's very hard to precisely measure the distance between two places. These particles are passing through the Earth's crust, so it isn't as though you can just lay out a tape measure from one location to the other. Moreover, you have to make sure that the clocks at the two positions where the particles begin and end, they must be synchronized to fantastic precision. You know, if someone runs a marathon and you're going to time how long it takes them, the clock at the finish line better be in sync with the clock at the starting line. And it's very hard to get clocks into sync.
If this is actually true, I mean, this could change the way we, you all, and then, of course, we all think about time and space, right?
Yes and no. So let me just point out that the idea that this would somehow throw Einstein out the window, that's just not true.
Okay.
E equals mc squared will still be with us. All the wonderful features of relativity will still be with us. We'll just have a more refined version of relativity to accommodate these results if they are true.
Because you actually really want to believe this. You're not being a skeptic just to be difficult.
Well, we live for things which change our understanding of reality. Mm. And that's what being a physicist is all about. So we want this to be true, but we don't think it is. We're waiting for the proof.
That's Brian Greene. He's a professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University, talking about experiments with neutrinos that may or may not prove they can travel faster than the speed of light. Brian Greene, thanks.
My pleasure.
And All Things Considered continues right after this.